night.
G'day, Cam. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
I have had one of the more interesting days of my 51-year life.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Nothing well, like feeling like you are in the middle of averting a worldwide political flap. I'll call it that.
A panic. Just,
a panic in a case where panic is never useful.
Yeah. All right. Well, Rod, why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Sure. I'm Rod Adams. I am the blogger at Atomic Insights, the host and producer of the Atomic Show podcast. I have been studying nuclear energy intensely since 1981. Was an engineer officer on board submarines. Learned all about nuclear energy, but also, very importantly, learned all about damage control and how to respond in the case of unusual and confusing situations.
Which I imagine, as somebody working around nuclear equipment, is kind of a key thing to know what to learn about, right? What to do when shit goes wrong.
Especially when it's nuclear-powered equipment that is operating on a moving platform several hundred feet underwater. It's always good to understand how to respond when shit goes differently than you expect.
Exactly. So now, I think as you said when we started the call, this is the moment you've been living your life for. I think over the last 5 or 6 years, you and I've had we've done a couple of shows together. You've done a lot of podcasts, written a lot of blog posts, and always talking about nuclear energy. And of course, on weeks like this week, that's when all eyes are on you. So let's get straight to the meat of it then. Fukushima, Japan, nuclear reactors. Are you concerned?
I'm concerned about Japan because they had an earthquake and a tsunami, and they have about 500,000 people who are homeless. They have people who don't have enough water. They're having trouble delivering food. They haven't found all the dead bodies yet. I'm very worried about Japan as a disaster area. There were a couple of nuclear power stations in the path of the tsunami, which, like all other man-made facilities in the path of the tsunami, have suffered some damage. However, nothing that is happening at those plants puts anyone outside the fence line at risk of anything, except for if some poorly or narrowly educated government officials start ordering people out of perfectly good homes because they are afraid of a few millirem, or I guess micro sieverts for those people who work in different systems of measure.
And for those of us who work in neither, how much radiation is a micro sievert or a millirem?
Okay, the average year-long dose for people living at sea level in the United States is roughly 300 to 600 millirem. And in micro sieverts or millisieverts, it's 100 times less than that, because that would mean 3 to 6 millisieverts is the average annual dose here in the U.S. Now, one of the things that people don't understand about radiation is it varies widely around the world. You still there?
Yeah, man, I'm listening.
Okay. All right. I got a little bit of a background, but that's all right. It varies widely around the world. There are places in the world where the natural background radiation is as high as 8,000 millirem per year. 8 rem, or let's see, and that's 80 millisieverts. Because there's areas in the world where there's, you know, things like uranium or thorium sands or hot springs that are heated with radioactive material that comes out of the magma. One of the highest natural radiation areas in the world is a place called Ramsar, Iran. But there's lots of other places that have as high as, say, 2,000 millirem per year or 4,000 millirem per year. And there's been a lot of studies done, and the people that live in those high background areas show no indication of elevated levels of anything. There's been a lot of studies in the world over the years. You know, we've been using man-made radiation quite a bit since the 1940s, and we've been doing some very detailed studies of populations, both accidentally exposed, those who are occupationally exposed, and a few others. And the studies are really pretty conclusive that as long as your annual dose is somewhere below 10,000 millirem, it's really hard to detect any danger to you.
Now, I've read on Twitter and in the mainstream media people saying things like, no level of radiation is safe.
Yes, that's right. There is an assumption that is made that the level of radiation or the danger from radiation is a linear function of the dose. It's called the linear no threshold dose response assumption assertion or something. It's not really a theory, and it's not really validated by science. But even if it is, that means that if you get a very low dose, you have a very low risk. Even if the risk is not zero, the normal risk of getting cancer if you are a human being who lives a modern life, in other words, you're not going to die before you get cancer, which would happen if you were living a non-modern life, you probably got about a 30% chance of dying of cancer of one form or another. And so is there a zero chance that some amount of radiation will give you a cancer? Some people say there's never a zero chance, but, man, it gets so close to zero that it's good enough for me.
I saw somebody say on Twitter again, I'm going to refer to Twitter a lot because there's been a lot of hysteria on Twitter that I've been trying to battle, and I've been abused severely as a result of it, which I always enjoy.
Yeah, I think you and I both love to be abused by idiots.
Well, particularly the thing that amuses me most is when you try and provide some counter facts against an argument and you immediately get called insane and beyond rational thinking.
I get called a shill all the time too. So
a shill for the nuclear industry, yeah.
Oh yeah.
So anyway, I saw somebody say that, you know, when people say no level of radiation is good for you, you have to ask them, well, what is sunlight? What do you think sunlight is? I mean, our planet is swathed in radiation from the sun. I've got some stats here that I wanted to talk about that I've pulled together over the last couple of days and to get your feedback on them. Somebody, let me see who this was. I got this out of R&D magazine by, let me see who this man is, John Lee, a professor in the Department of Nuclear Engineering and Radiological Sciences, I think at the University of Michigan, said... for the general public, I don't believe he's talking about the risks, like the worst case scenario risk in Japan. For the public, I don't believe it would be much higher than two additional chest X-rays.
Okay. Sounds reasonable.
And he was citing the results of Three Mile Island, which I understand that Fukushima now is thought to be at a higher stage or a worse stage than Three Mile Island, somewhere between that and Chernobyl, the last I heard.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like saying that a guy with a couple of quarters in his pocket is somewhere between a guy with nothing and a guy who is Warren Buffett.
So not exactly a scientific estimation.
There's orders of magnitude here. I mean, yeah. Three Mile Island was a economic catastrophe for the company that owned the plant. because they were never able to fix it and restart it. So the asset was only a few months old, and it was never run again. So it was a catastrophe for them. All of the radioactive material was retained within the pressure vessel. Didn't even get to the containment. You know, the pressure vessel is a big, thick-walled steel vessel inside the containment, and it's roughly 5 to 6 inches thick. Then there's a building around that thick container. At Three Mile Island, the fuel, between 40 and 50% of the fuel melted, went down to the bottom of the pressure vessel and refroze. It penetrated the pressure vessel to a depth of 5/8 of an inch. So if you're thinking you're going to go to China by melting through the bottom of a pressure vessel, you got a long way to go if you only get 5/8 of an inch with the very worst thing that can happen.
Which is where the term the China syndrome comes from, right? It's going to burn a hole all the way to China.
Right. Well, the China syndrome is a fantasy. I mean, that just doesn't work in the real world. It can't happen.
Okay, so that was TMI, too much information, Three Mile Island. Is the situation at Fukushima, how much worse is it at this stage? We're recording this Thursday, March 17th, in the evening my time, in the very early hours of the morning your time in the US. Well, I mean, and I know you've been up for a couple of hours getting up to date. How much worse than Three Mile Island is the current situation in Fukushima?
Well, I would say that the current situation at Fukushima is like having three individual Three Mile Islands next to each other at the same time in the same place. In other words, since the hazard to the public from Three Mile Island was zero, it's exactly three times zero. I'm sorry. That's the reality. It's a pain in the butt. But
I mean, everyone keeps talking about the threat of the fuel rods completely melting down through the containment vessel. Do you see that as a likely possibility at this stage?
No, it's a no possibility. I'll share a link with you to an article that some very eminent scientists, including an old friend of mine named Ted Rockwell, wrote for Science Magazine in 2002. And what they did was they analyzed all of the experimental data that they had, and they had $1 billion worth of experiments. They analyzed the postmortem at Three Mile Island. They, you know, we actually took that place apart and tried to figure out exactly what happened. And they came up with what the very worst possible thing can happen in a light water reactor that's licensed to standards that have been in place since the 1950s. In other words, where you got a pressure vessel and you got a big thick wall vessel around it. And they even assume that somebody deliberately attacked the container to put a hole in it. And what they determined was, yeah, I'm still here. You still there?
Yeah, I said right. Yeah, and?
Yeah. And so what they determined was even with all those worst case things, the result would be few, if any, measurable impacts to the public. And Ted emphasizes the if any part. He says, really, he fought for him to say zero, but nobody wanted to say zero, just like very few people want to say there's zero chance of getting cancer from very low levels of radiation.
Yeah.
Some people don't like the word zero. Yeah. You know, there's an old joke about scientists and engineers. Have you ever heard that?
Probably not.
All right. So you get this person who's in a room, and there's a scientist and an engineer next to each other. And on the other side of the room, there's a pot of gold or a really beautiful woman, whichever way you want to tell the story.
Maybe a beautiful woman with a pot of
gold. Okay, there you go. And the rule of the game that these two people play is that each one can only go halfway to the goal with every step. And that they're never allowed to go any more than halfway. So the scientist says, well, I'm not going to play this game. I can never get there. The engineer goes across the room, grabs a woman, grabs a gold, and says, I can get close enough.
Okay, very good. Very good. So that's why people don't want to say absolutely zero.
Correct. Because you can always, you know, put another another zero in front of your decimal point or on the aft side of your decimal point. Anyway. Yeah.
That's I mean, and that's a good thing about sinus. We don't want them stating things that are factually incorrect, but it tends sometimes to give the general public the wrong perception, right?
Absolutely. That's the difference between a scientist and an engineer, again, is sometimes we have to say things are certain because we've actually put enough engineering slop in there to make sure that we're standing on solid ground when we say that. Mm. You know, when we say that we're not going to fall out of the sky, we hope that people actually get on the airplane and believe us that we're not going to fall out of the sky. Now, yes, there is a chance, always a chance that gravity will win, but you know, humans actually defy gravity on a regular basis.
Now, does the fact that this plant is, I think it was built in the 70s, and mm-hmm. I'm sure you've seen the stuff that WikiLeaks has released, the IAEA warned Japan that its safety guidelines were outdated a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Does this change things, the fact that this is an old plant? Is it as secure as this study that was done, this report that was written you just referred to?
Yes, because the plant that was destroyed at Three Mile Island was built to those standards as well. I mean, Three Mile Island was 1979, so they were built to essentially the same standards. Things got changed after Three Mile Island, and they've been changed many times since. But I liken it to this. If somebody gave me a 1970 Corvette that didn't have an airbag and didn't have seat belts and didn't have a headrest and didn't have anti-lock brakes, what I say, man, I'm not going to take that car because it's not built to current standards. No, I'd take the car and I'd drive a little more carefully.
Okay, and that analogy is?
Well, that's the same thing. You have the older plants are not built to the same stringent standards as today's plants. That doesn't mean they're unsafe. It doesn't mean that the people back in the 1960s were stupid or, you know, risk takers. It just means that since then, people have learned a little bit and added some additional features. That doesn't mean you have to keep going back and refitting the old stuff. It still works. You just have to take care.
So explain to us then how Three Mile Island and Fukushima are different from Chernobyl, because I think most lay people don't know the difference between the three.
Okay. Well, the first thing about Chernobyl that people have to understand is that it was a reactor design that included both graphite and water. And what that meant was that the graphite served as a moderator. It actually would make the neutrons a little bit more effective than they normally would be without the moderator. And the water served as a coolant. But water also has a tendency that it will absorb some neutrons. So not only does it make the reaction go better, at some places it makes the reaction go worse. It's hard to explain exactly. But in a very unusual circumstance, and it wasn't throughout the whole operating curves, but only in a very unusual circumstance would the reactor at Chernobyl be unstable. And there were other reactors that were built similar to Chernobyl that worked just fine as long as the operators were well-trained and avoided those little places where it was a little unstable. And you had to be in very specific circumstance. You had to have had a high power level and shut down to a low power level, and then gone up to a little bit higher power level, and then come back down to a lower power level. And eventually, you could get yourself into this unstable position because of the way that...
And that's what they did at Chernobyl?
And at Chernobyl, they did that. I mean, they actually were doing experiments that were designed by an electrical engineer, not a nuclear engineer. And the operators were fairly typical... people in a hierarchical society where they believe their boss. And the boss said to do this, they said, well, it's not exactly what we're trained to do, but we'll do what the boss says.
Or we'll get sent to a gulag.
Exactly.
So what happened? What was the net effect of all of that?
So they got to an unstable position. They didn't. They overrode a bunch of safety features. They actually turned off the switches to the safety features, got themselves in a bad situation, and they – had an excursion. They actually had a place where the reactor power level got really high, really fast for a brief period of time. That started a fire in the graphite, and it started a reaction between the water and the graphite. And so the thing actually started burning, and they also only had a confinement system, not a containment system. And so the burning and the water flashing the steam caused a big eruption that blew off the confinement. And so you had this exposed core that was sitting there on fire, heating up, bubbling water out, and not being confined at all from the environment. So a lot of radioactive material got thrown out at the initial eruption. You know, there was pieces of core laying around the area, and they formed some hot spots. And then the radioisotopes were being just thrown off into the atmosphere, sort of like all of the material that's coming out of the refinery that's still on fire at Chiba in Japan. I mean, there's a refinery that's been burning for 5 days now, dumping all kinds of nasty stuff into the atmosphere without any confinement at all. And for some reason, we're focused on a nuclear plant that's not dumping anything yet. I just don't understand.
Well, I want to get to the issue of why all of the hysteria around nuclear in a minute, but let's stay on the health risks and dangers and comparing it to something like Chernobyl, and we've already compared it to Three Mile Island. I read something here. Where we go. Discover magazine, a science magazine, an article a few days ago called Whatever Happens Next, Let's Think Clearly About Nuclear Risks. And the author, Chris Mooney, who hosts the Point of Inquiry podcast and is a science writer, refers to something that risk assessment scholar David Ropick, who wrote an article at Scientific American, said recently, and some interesting stats here that I thought of you when I read. Says nuclear energy certainly has its risks, but are they as great as those from burning coal and oil, given what's happening to the climate of the Earth? Are nuclear emissions, including releases from accidents, as bad as the particulate pollution from fossil fuels? Not even close. Remember the low radiation-induced cancer death toll among the Hibakusha survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or the World Health Organization's estimate of 4,000 lifetime cancer deaths from radiation for Chernobyl. Fossil fuel particulates kill several hundred thousand people around the world each year. Then in brackets, he says, estimates for this risk are all over the place, but Dr. Joel Schwartz of the Harvard School of Public Health, a pioneer in the study of air pollution risks, estimates the number could be as high as 250,000 in the United States alone annually. Estimates for the annual U.S. death toll from fossil fuel particulate pollution on the low end are 20 to 30,000. So 4,000 lifetime cancer deaths from radiation at Chernobyl versus somewhere between 20 and hundreds of thousands each year for fossil fuels. It just, when you read numbers like that, it makes me wonder why this level of hysteria.
Absolutely, and particularly when you have, if you go and you read the most recent update of the study at Chernobyl, and you also read the words carefully, it doesn't say 4,000 deaths. It says as many as 4,000 deaths.
So that's an
people
upper
that
limit.
I know. That's an upper limit, and if you figure out the math involved in the upper limit, that's based on that linear no threshold dose assumption that I talked about before. And it's based on people using a very large population of people exposed to very tiny amounts of radiation. And if you have a very large number against even a very small number, you can come up with something that sounds kind of scary, like 4,000. But you know, they're measuring against a very large, very lightly exposed population.
Okay, so let's.
I think it's going to be a lot lower than 4,000 myself.
So and let's talk then about why the level of hysteria. What's your best guess on why we see so much hysteria involving nuclear accidents?
Because nuclear fission is an extremely disruptive technology that threatens the entire world order.
Well, you want to keep going? I mean, that's excellent.
Okay.
So there
are people that recognize that our industrial economy should also be known as a hydrocarbon economy. It is based on, mm-hmm. I mean, the way that we moved away from agrarian societies is we started to use stored energy that the world had stored up over many millions of years, coal and oil and natural gas, and we use that energy to do work that people just couldn't do and neither could animals. It's calculated that here in the United States, we have roughly the equivalent of about 50 to 60 people working for us every year in the form of burning hydrocarbons. There were some folks back in the 50s that used to actually calculate in terms of energy slaves. You know, when you calculate how much work a man can do working full-time, hard labor, and calculate how much power and energy that man can deliver to his servant, that's where we, you know, come up with this energy slaves concept. We have, you know, slaves that keep our food cool and move it around from place to place and you know, make materials for us and cut wood and do all kinds of things that used to be done by human beings.
And it's all driven by coal, oil, and natural gas.
Correct. And so if you have this economy that's built on that, the people who are selling that basic raw material for the industrial society really care about how much they sell it for. You know, I'm not saying that the demand for oil would disappear if there was more nuclear, but I am saying that the demand for oil would be far less. And if you're a market player like I am, you recognize that it doesn't take much difference between supply and demand in a commodity like oil or gas or coal to really make a difference in price. I mean, it wasn't very long ago at all that I was driving down the road and I was hearing a discussion where the OPEC oil ministers were trying to figure out what they needed to do to adjust the supply to be able to drive the price of oil above $20 a gallon. Okay, this was, you know, within the last 10 years.
And they decided that they needed to have they needed to be invaded by the U.S.?
You know, if you look at the – and you have to remember the world – the oil market is not necessarily monolithic. There's lots of different players involved. But every one of them knows that they make more money when the price of their commodity is higher, as long as they're allowed to keep selling. However, if they can prevent one of their competitors from selling for a while, they can drive the price up. So there's a whole lot of people in the oil and gas business that might have been very interested in knocking out Iraqi production for a few years because that would leave more room in the market for them and at higher prices. If you ever read the book The Prize, it's a wonderful book. You remember what the subtitle of that book is?
Oh,
The Quest for Oil, Money, and Power.
So your theory, to summarize then, is that the hysteria that we see in the mainstream media and we hear from our governments around nuclear is in a very large part driven by a protectionist mentality from the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, and it's not monolithic. It's no conspiracy or anything like this. It's simply the knowledge that every commodity supplier of any kind knows how the law of supply and demand works, and knows that they not want to try to manipulate that law in their own favor. You know, if you can raise the barrier to entry to a competitor, I mean, they taught this in business school, right? You took business school. You raise the barrier of entry to a competitor, you are able to achieve pricing power. You know, Warren Buffett loves talking about how that's what he looks for in a company. He doesn't care if they sell a product that's really good for the world or something really valuable or creative or innovative. He just wants a company that has pricing power, that basically is a place where the customer has no real choice. If you go to your, he loves it when you can have a company that tells their customers, ah, we're going to raise our prices this year by 10%. And then it goes next year, we're going to raise our price again by 10%. And there's nobody that comes in and says, we're going to undercut you. He likes pricing power. That's why he buys railroads. You know, it's hard to undercut a railroad that transports coal, for example. You know, there's only a few tracks. There's, you know, nobody else who can carry that big bulky product. You know, you're not going to move it on trucks. So yes.
So, Rod, let me ask you about nuclear waste. I mean, one of the concerns that some of my friends have when we talk about nuclear is nuclear waste. We're producing all this stuff, and mm-hmm. it's going to be around for 24,000 years. I mean, what's your position on the creation of nuclear waste material?
First of all, I call it used nuclear fuel, vice nuclear waste, and it's only lightly used. When we take fuel out of a reactor today, because we're still using 1950s vintage technology, it still contains about 95% of the potential energy that it could have if we used somewhat more fuel-efficient means of consuming it. It's basically like going into a forest and needing to build a fire, but being too lazy to learn how to chop wood. So all you do is you burn the kindling, you burn the little twigs, because the rest of the stuff is hard to get started. You know, it's hard to burn a log, right? Well, that's essentially what we do with uranium. We mine this stuff out of the ground. It's got two isotopes. It's got uranium-235 and uranium-238. The 235 is like the kindling, and it fissions pretty easily. But there's only 0.7% of the mined uranium is 235. The rest of it's 238. Now, 238 can fission as well, but it takes a little bit more technology and a couple more neutrons. It takes two neutrons instead of one. So you got to be a little more efficient with your neutrons to make sure that you get that stuff lit up and burning. And you probably have heard about Bill Gates and his traveling wave reactor.
Nope.
You haven't heard about that? Okay. Well,
is that like a teleportation engine?
No. Oh, actually, okay. A traveling wave reactor is simply a reactor that is configured so that instead of burning just the kindling, you get the kindling hot, but you surround it with the wood, the logs, and you make sure you burn the logs too. You get a better fire going. So instead of having a reactor that burns, you know, roughly 0.5% of the initial fuel, it may burn 50 or 60 or 70%, which is a pretty huge improvement when you think about it. So a lot of the used nuclear fuel is simply that. It's material that can be recycled into new reactors.
So it doesn't need to be stuck in the ground in the middle of Australia, is one of the things that always gets brought up here, or shot into space. It can be reused.
Right. And until you get to the point where you really need to reuse it, it can also be relatively easily stored because it's not very big. It's, you know, in the U.S., we've been using a pretty fair amount of nuclear energy for several decades now. We have accumulated a grand total of about 65,000 tons of used nuclear fuel, which sounds like a really big number, except if you put all of that material in licensed storage containers, you wouldn't fill a space as big as a large football stadium. The whole country, and that would be single level, I mean, the floor space of a large football stadium. Okay, so it's not a very large amount. And, you know, that just even by the amount of mass, you know, a large coal-fired power plant can be dumping about 40,000 tons of CO2 into the atmosphere every single day. So in 2 days, a coal plant dumps more waste into the environment than the nuclear production in the U.S. has created. And we don't dump ours in the environment. We keep it in stored containers.
I've just looked up traveling wave reactor and saw that a company called Intellectual Ventures launched a subsidiary called TerraPower in 2006 to commercialize in practical engineering terms such a reactor. And of course, Intellectual Ventures I know of quite well because it's
Myhrvold
and run by Nathan Myhrvold, former CTO of Microsoft. And it says Bill Gates featured TerraPower in his 2010 TED Talks. So these aren't complete quacks that we're talking about here.
No. Well, and I hope unlike that people you and understand, me. People should understand that you may be a quack. And I'm an atomic nut or an atomic
you're
advocate.
You're a shill.
I'm a shill. I'm an atomic obsessive, actually, is what I am. I've been obsessing about this technology since 1981. And I started a company in 1993 thinking that I was going to, you know, build small nuclear power plants. Now, nobody in their right mind in 1993 even thought about the idea that nuclear power plants could be small. But if you look up small modular reactors today, you'll recognize there's a whole bunch of people, a whole bunch of different companies around the world, some very fine companies like Babcock & Wilcox, the company I work for now, that is working on small modular reactors.
Well, Rod, when I make my first billion, I'll be investing in your nuclear reactors. Mate, we should leave it there. Thanks for taking the time to chat. I know you're getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and working around the clock to keep your head around all of this. And I know you're doing a lot of interviews and a lot of writing, and appreciate you taking the time to come on and have a chat, mate. People should check out Atomic Insights, the Atomic Show on TPN, which is a show you've been doing for us here for 5 or 6 years now. And you've covered this subject 27 ways from Sunday, and that was before Fukushima. So it's good to know people who know shit at times like this.
Hey, let me just give the whole URL.
Yeah,
it's atomicinsights.blogspot.com. And of course, the Atomic Show podcast is atomic.thepodcastnetwork.com.
I will have links to both of those in the show notes. Actually, I talked about your blog on the show I did last night as well. So I'm urging people to get a different perspective from the hysteria we hear on the mainstream media to go and check out your stuff and all of the people that you link to and write about. Thank you, mate.
I do want to make one more comment.
Yeah.
Everybody, please think hard about how you can help provide food, water, and shelter to the people in Japan. That's what they really, really need. The lack of water will kill people a lot faster than a few stray gamma rays.
And of course, you're on Twitter, Atomic Rod.
Yes.
Good on you, mate. Have a good day.
Take care.
Cheers.
You too. Bye.